Speaker, if we have $500,000 to spend on vitamin D, I have a very difficult time standing up and supporting a reduced dividend.
The House votes to restore PFD amounts to the full amount this year, $2,700. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, thousands march around the state for gun reform.
We all believe that no more innocent children need to lose their life in what is supposed to be a safe place.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
UA is working to build Alaska's future workforce with investment in UA-educated teachers. Individuals interested in a future in teaching can apply for the President's Teach for Alaska Scholarship for degree studies at any of the UA campuses. An education from the University of Alaska is an investment in the future. Application period closes May 1st. More at alaska.edu/learn-to-teach. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
The Alaska House voted 21-19 this morning to restore the full amount for Alaska Permanent Fund dividends this year. PFDs would be roughly $2,700. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on the arguments for and against the change.
The vote would add nearly $900 million to the proposed state budget. This would decrease state savings since there is no new revenue to offset the increase. Minority Caucus Republicans provided most of the support for restoring the dividends to the full amount set under a legal formula used until 2 years ago. Eagle River Republican Representative Dan Sadler says the PFD shouldn't be cut until the budget for state government services is smaller. He supported cutting a study of vitamin D deficiency funded in the budget.
The budget is rising despite the efforts of me and my caucus to hold down to reduce the size of government and even just to slow the rate of increase have been unsuccessful time after time after time. So, Mr. Speaker, if we have $500,000 to spend on vitamin D, I have a very difficult time standing up and supporting a reduced dividend.
The mostly Democratic House majority was nearly evenly divided. 10 voted for the funding, while 12 voted against it. Anchorage Democratic Representative Garen Tarr says the PFD shouldn't be cut until the legislature passes a plan that closes the long-term gap between how much the state spends and how much it brings in. The majority has proposed higher oil and gas taxes or a tax on income as part of a comprehensive plan.
And it shouldn't lie on the shoulders of our children, our seniors, our veterans, and those on fixed incomes and lower income Alaskans to solve the budget crisis. Everybody needs to give in a way that's meaningful, and those are the Alaskans who have given the most so far.
Some opponents also say PFD cuts hurt lower-income residents, but they say a larger PFD this year threatens future PFDs by chipping away at permanent fund earnings as well as funding for state services. Fairbanks Democratic Representative Adam Wohl says the state can't afford the full amount.
I know there's some people that make counterarguments that since we didn't get a more distributed revenue package that we should ditch this, but I'm not one of those people. I think this is really important to stick with it, stick with our plan, and forge ahead.
And some opponents like Anchorage Representative Chris Birch argue that the PFD spending mirrors larger patterns in state spending. He was one of 7 minority caucus Republicans to vote no.
I think it's spending money we don't have. We've got a reputation collectively of doing that, and I think we can't afford it. I think we need to take a very hard look at this budget effort.
Governor Bill Walker vetoed roughly half of the PFD money in 2016, and the legislature cut the money by more than half last year. The House adjourned Monday after taking the vote in the morning. It's not clear how the House will fund the PFD, and it's not clear what will happen to the PFD in the Senate. Last year, the House proposed $1,250 dividends, and the Senate proposed $1,000 dividends. They compromised on an $1,100 amount. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
A weekend incident in Anchorage has left a man dead after police say he came at an officer wielding a knife. On Monday morning, officials identified the deceased as 20-year-old Xander M. Clark after his next of kin had been notified. The incident started Saturday evening when a bystander called police about a stabbing between a couple in the parking lot of a Home Depot. A woman ran into the business with non-life-threatening injuries from a knife wound. After slashing two tires, the assailant fled on foot. In a video of a Saturday night press conference at APD headquarters posted by Channel 2 News, Chief Justin Dahl said officers followed Clark into an East Anchorage trailer park.
At that point, the person that was being chased turned and ran towards the officer while armed with a knife, and the officer shot and killed him.
As per APD's protocols, all shootings involving officers are investigated to establish whether the use of deadly force was justified. The officer's name is withheld until 3 days after the incident. This is the first deadly shooting involving police in Anchorage this year. In 2017, the city saw four such incidents. A Nikolayevsk man is dead and an Alaska State Trooper sustained serious injuries after an officer-involved shooting Saturday evening. Troopers say 42-year-old Nikolai Yakunin was shot after he assaulted an officer, but it's unclear how the altercation happened and if Yakunin was armed. KBBI's Aaron Bolton has more.
Troopers in Anchor Point received a report that Yakunin was in contact with a female who he was prohibited from speaking to under his probation conditions. Troopers received the report at 2:17 Saturday afternoon and responded to Yakunin's residence off Nikolayevsk Road on the south side of the small village of 350 people about 5 hours later at 7:07 p.m. Yakunin's father, also named Nikolai, was leading services at the local church when he says his wife told him about the shooting.
I went out and she said our son has been shot, possibly killed, and she was crying.
Yakunin says he went to the house where troopers confirmed his son was dead on the scene. He says troopers have not disclosed any more information to him or his family.
It'd be nice to find out what really happened with the trooper going into Nick's house and a little getting into a fight with Nick, or Nick getting in a fight with the trooper.
Yakunin doesn't think his son had any firearms. He also says the community is disappointed with the trooper's use of force and says it was police brutality.
Is this practice as troopers just to, I mean, we know he was not armed. I mean, he might have had a pipe or something, but other than that, he had no firearm.
According to a trooper dispatch, the responding trooper was incapacitated after Yakunin attacked him and additional troopers were dispatched for backup. Troopers say Yakunin continued his, quote, assaultive behavior, and he was shot to prevent further assaults on any trooper or bystander, end quote. According to court records, Yakunin has been indicted on several assault charges dating back to late 2013, including a charge for threatening to hit troopers with a metal pipe in May of last year. The release does not say how Yakunin attacked the responding officer and that the trooper was transported to South Peninsula Hospital in Homer with serious injuries. Trooper spokesperson Tim Despain said the trooper was still hospitalized late Monday afternoon. The trooper who shot and killed Yakunin has not been named and has been placed on standard 72-hour administrative leave. Troopers say the investigation is ongoing. Yakunin's funeral is planned later this week. Reporting in Homer, I'm Aaron Bolton.
From Bethel and Fairbanks to Anchorage and Juneau, people across Alaska gathered on Saturday in solidarity with March for Our Lives in Washington, D.C. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early has more on the statewide marches.
Anchorage marchers carried signs showing varying messages such as thoughts and prayers are not bulletproof and books, not bullets.
Hey,
about 1,000 people attended. The march kicked off with speeches from local student organizers. One of them was Keegan Blaine, a junior at A.J. Diamond High School.
We all believe that no more innocent children need to lose their life in what is supposed to be a safe place.
The organizers want to raise the minimum age to own a firearm from 18 to 21, among other demands. They say high schoolers shouldn't be allowed to own guns. March organizers also want to require background checks for gun show purchases and reclassify certain weapons and ammunition magazines as military grade. Alaska has the highest percentage of gun ownership among adults in the country. High school junior and speaker James Schultz insists the March for Our Lives movement does not want to take away people's firearms.
I don't want to take your Second Amendment rights. I've got family and friends that have guns, and what we want is gun reform. So we want it to be harder to get a gun, but easy enough that if you're healthy and you are doing all the right things, you can get one.
In Bethel, about 30 people joined the march, carrying signs and walking the slushy shoulder of Chief Eddie Hoffman Highway. Most of those who took to the Bethel street were students, teachers, school administrators, parents, and grandparents. Here's 17-year-old organizer Kelly O'Brien talking about her sign.
It says, "At 17, I have seen 192 school shootings. I refuse to see another." I made this sign when we did the student walkout, and that number was 188. And since the Parkland school shooting, there have been four more school shootings in the United States. So I'm marching for stricter gun laws and regulations and just keeping students safe in school.
Bethel Regional High School was the site of a school shooting more than 20 years ago, where Principal Ron Edwards and student Josh Palacios lost their lives. While the students marching wouldn't have been old enough to remember the tragedy, Utletnarvet Learning Center Executive Director Mike Hoffman says the effects of the shooting can still be felt in Bethel.
I see it every day at our school, and we're already practicing our shooting lockdowns and everything, and that's something that I know that I have four people that work in that school that were here during the school shooting 20 years ago. And just to watch their face when we started that whole process is just, I feel so sad for them.
In Juneau, Anchorage Democratic Representative Garen Tarr spoke at the rally at the state's capitol. Tarr introduced House Bill 75 last year. It establishes red flag laws that allow judges to remove guns from the homes of people at higher risk of committing acts of violence.
And the idea is that you're trying to intervene in a crisis situation and prevent someone from harming themselves or others, and using the court to help you intervene by removing the guns.
The bill has had several hearings in the House Judiciary Committee, and Tarr says she's hopeful it will be moved out next week. With help from Adeline Baxter in Juneau and Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the village of Marshall struggles to fight crime without police officers.
Living in a village without public safety, there's a feeling of uneasiness. We never know what's going to happen.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
Detours forced by a damaged bridge on the Glen Highway ended in time for the state's busiest commute this morning. As Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove reports, the state has cited a semi-driver for hitting the bridge.
A tall load carried atop a semi-trailer slammed into the bridge near Eagle River on Wednesday, causing a reroute of the highway's southbound lanes and severe delays for tens of thousands of drivers. A damaged 100-ton steel girder was at risk of falling, and crews were able to remove it by Sunday and reopen the highway. An average of 57,000 vehicles travel the highway each day between Anchorage and the Matanuska-Susitna borough to the north. The Department of Transportation initially reported the height of the bridge as 18.5 feet, but later said the bridge's clearance is actually 17.5 feet over the southbound lanes. Still, DOT says the trucking company Bighorn Enterprises only had a permit to move a load up to 17 feet tall, which it apparently exceeded, and the department's Division of Commercial Vehicle Enforcement issued the driver a citation. In a statement on its now-deleted Facebook page, Bighorn Enterprises apologized to South Central Alaska commuters. The statement said the load that struck the bridge was a module from a dismantled camp and was not the load Bighorn's driver was expecting or was told by the customer they would be hauling. The state says it plans to pursue recouping the cost of repairing the bridge, estimated to be about $1.8 million. In Anchorage, I'm Casey Grove.
Earlier this month, the village of Marshall in southwest Alaska pushed Governor Walker to issue an emergency declaration in their community due to a worsening law enforcement situation. For most of the past two decades, Marshall has been without police. As KYUK's Teresa Katsourilis reports, residents there are working out ways to defend their community on their own.
Living in a village without public safety, there's a feeling of uneasiness. We never know what's going to happen.
Nick Andrews is the tribal administrator in Marshall. It's a tight-knit community of about 500 people, but Andrews says they really need police. He says opioids are becoming a problem. Crimes related to alcohol intoxication increased after Bethel's liquor store opened, and there's been a rise in gun crimes. Andrews can remember five times in the past year when shooters have put Marshall on lockdown.
99% of the time they're intoxicated, enraged. We've had houses being hit with bullets, windows pierced with bullets.
Marshall's residents have started organizing the lockdowns themselves over VHF radios, and there are five young men in town who've taken it upon themselves to help their neighbors.
They have been making citizens' arrests. They have been protecting victims. And these young men aren't vigilantes. These are caring individuals.
They don't have any police training, but they did manage to talk down Marshall's last shooter back in October. Marshall's tribal council unanimously passed a resolution earlier this month, urging Governor Walker to issue an emergency declaration for their region. They hope to generate enough resources to get some law enforcement in the village. It was Andrew's idea.
We're caught in the perfect storm. Funding, lagging tribal justice programs, and the regional nonprofit with its own issues.
There are different kinds of law enforcement that operate in the villages, each financed by a different governing body. All of them are underfunded. Marshall's nearest trooper post is a few communities away in St. Mary's, and the weather can delay troopers for days.
I think there should be a trooper or two in every community.
Walt Monaghan is Alaska's Commissioner of Public Safety. He says the state just doesn't have the money to do this, and it's struggling to find enough applicants for existing trooper positions as it is. Another law enforcement option is a Village Public Safety Officer, or VPSO, which Marshall could get through their regional nonprofit, the Association of Village Council Presidents. But according to Alvin Jimmy, who runs that program, the state only awarded funding for 10 VPSO positions there this year, and the region has 56 villages. Marshall doesn't have any tribal police officers. Its tribes are just beginning to set up their justice system now. And as a municipality, Marshall could employ a village police officer, but it would use state money to fund that position, and state money is drying up. Over the past two decades, Marshall has managed to get a village police officer or a VPSO two or three times, says Nick Andrews, but they've always left within a year. In a small town with a high crime rate, AVCP's Alvin Jimmy says the job can burn officers out.
There'll be times you'll be dealing with your best friends. That's the biggest thing that I stress out, is that if they ever do become VPSOs, don't expect a lot of friends.
Jimmy encouraged applicants who want to become VPSOs to give him a call and get their applications in. In Marshall, residents are on edge, as Nick Andrews knows all too well. His own daughter was assaulted in town by a man named Leon Edwards last January, and Andrews ran to Edwards' house and fought him off himself.
I'm cornered. If anything was to happen to me, nobody would have known anything at that hour.
The troopers were called in to investigate, and Edwards was charged with five counts of assault. But a week before our interview, Andrews was still running into Leon Edwards in the village.
I was on alert. I have to be friendly, you know, hi, hello, here's my guns.
He points to his muscles. The troopers haven't arrested Edwards yet. Trooper spokesperson Megan Peters says they've been to Marshall several times, but they haven't been able to take Edwards into custody. So for now, the community copes as best it can. In Bethel, I'm Teresa Katsourilis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside of Alaska, and it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game says it has been overestimating how many Chinook and sockeye salmon make it up the Taku River. The Juneau Empire reported on Sunday that department officials say the statistical bias is being corrected by new state-of-the-art studies. The department says it had been overestimating the salmon numbers by 30% to 40%. It says seal predation caused much of the problem. The department says the discrepancy doesn't mean either of the stocks are any worse off than they have been. But fishers are concerned the bias could affect ongoing negotiations with Canada over who has the right to harvest sockeye, since both countries fish on the river. Alaska bans salmon farms, saying they threaten wild fish runs. Now Washington State is joining the cause. Its governor, Jay Inslee, has signed a ban on non-native fish farms into law. The measure gives the state's remaining Atlantic salmon farms 4 years to shut down their operations. KUOW's John Ryan has more.
Atlantic salmon farming is nothing new to Washington State, but the collapse of a floating farm near Anacortes last August let as many as 250,000 fish escape. That great escape also led state officials, including Governor Inslee, to take a much dimmer view of the industry.
This bill will phase out non-native marine net pens in Puget Sound. These present a risk to our wild salmon runs that we cannot tolerate.
A state investigation faulted Cook Aquaculture for letting its fish farm get severely corroded and overgrown with algae and mussels. The Canadian company purchased all the salmon farms in Washington State 2 years ago. A statement from Cook says Inslee's decision to sign the bill ignores science. Tribes and environmental groups say the move will get rid of one threat to the region's wild salmon. I'm John Ryan reporting.
The Juneau School Board is considering adopting new curriculum for middle and high schools based on growing national science standards. The model has been adopted by 19 states, and one of the core ideas is teaching students about climate change. The standards don't shy away from attributing it to an increase in human activity, but how that's taught in the classroom could be up to interpretation. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has the story.
What's scary is that there's uncertainty because we don't know when to travel on the ice.
That's a clip from a documentary called Inuit Observations on Climate Change. It's part of the new curriculum a team of educators and the Juneau School District put together. In the past 5 years, the way that science is taught in the classroom across the nation has shifted. Pop quizzes are still a thing, but next-generation science standards challenge students to think systematically.
You still have the content there, but the focus has changed.
Ted Wilson helped oversee the new curriculum for the Juneau School District. A key part of the science standards is that students graduate with an understanding of Earth and human activity, and that includes learning about climate change. The standards don't mince words. What caused climate change to accelerate? It's us. The Juneau School District is borrowing some core ideas from the new standards. But Wilson says how those ideas are taught in the classroom is up to the teachers. There's no school district policy on climate change. Wilson's advice is to stick to it's happening.
The aspect of how much of it is human-caused, because there is still a lot of controversy about that, is to teach it as this is one stream of thought.
One stream of thought, Wilson says, that humans contributed to our most recent climate change.
Present it like that and for students to come away with their own opinions about whether they think humans have made that impact or not.
Well, there are facts about who is causing recent climate change, and the fact is that it's us.
That's Glenn Branch, a deputy director at the National Center for Science Education. The nonprofit advocates for evidence-based science in the classroom. Branch says there's a social controversy over climate change, but there isn't a scientific one. Scientists all over the world have studied this, and the overwhelming majority have reached the same conclusion. Humans are largely to blame. It's not an opinion, Branch says. It involves climate models and math. And that doesn't leave room for avoiding the facts or debating them.
It's inappropriate, both because it reinforces a false conception that there's a legitimate scientific debate about climate change, and also because it misrepresents the nature of science.
Still, Branch's states are trying to navigate this all across the country. With topics that can be perceived as controversial, like climate change, he says it's understandable school districts don't want to make waves. While there are still social issues, he says, that can be debated, like carbon taxes.
You certainly don't have it about issues such as human impact on climate or the shape of the earth.
But Ted Wilson from the Juneau School District doesn't take issue with climate change being presented in the classroom like a debate. Has human activity accelerated it or not? He says debates regularly happen in history class or language arts.
Where do you draw the line? Because there's also like flat earth theory. Would that be something that you would consent to, like a science teacher teaching?
As far as something that they're asking students to debate, they could.
Bottom line, Wilson says, is students should be able to think critically and then decide on their own how to interpret the world, whether it's flat earth theory or climate change. Regardless of what's accelerating warming, how can we adapt? That's the takeaway, he says.
I think in our political climate, we don't want teachers to be seen as people that are trying to push an agenda.
Teaching students about climate change is also part of the state's science standards. But a spokesperson from the Alaska Department of Education says it's largely up to the school districts to decide how that's done. Next year, the department will be able to offer some new guidance. The state is currently updating its science standards. After being reviewed by teachers, parents, and industry, it'll be posted for public comment in 2019. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Zachariah Hughes and Casey Grove in Anchorage, Aaron Bolton in Homer, Teresa Katsarilis in Bethel, and John Ryan in Seattle. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medications prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Never miss another episode of your favorite PBS primetime programs thanks to Afternoon Tea on Alaska Public Media TV. Every weekday, you can catch up on the drama of Masterpiece. Be amazed by our universe with Nature and Nova. Search for garage treasures on Antiques Roadshow and solve mysteries alongside our favorite detectives. Watch Afternoon Tea weekdays from 3 to 5 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. Public media is about you, the community we serve. Thank you for tuning in. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.